Hello and welcome to this week's show, Enemies of Good Art. Today we're going to talk about the work-family dilemma and the choices that women have to make in terms of career and family commitments. This is the last show in the series for us, and we'll be taking a break from today until the 14th of January, when we return with a discussion on when might be a good time to have a baby, and in particular talking to younger women who haven't had children yet, but are thinking of doing so. I'm joined in the studio today by Kenny Ash. She's the founder partner of Ash Sekula Architects, a London-based architectural firm. And she's also an RIBA competitions advisor and the Stirling Prize jury member. Rachel Anderson is head of interaction with Archangel. Previously, she was the education and outreach manager at the South London Gallery. And she's also a practicing artist. And we're joined on the phone by Camilla Brown. She's currently the senior curator at the Photographers Gallery in London, where she's been for the last in post for the last 11 years. Previous to that, she worked for as curator at Tate Liverpool. And we're going to start with Camilla, if we can. And Camilla was the inspiration for this show. I received an email from Camilla saying that she was leaving her post at the Photographers Gallery after 11 years to spend more time with her son. And I was thinking that there's something about the work-life balance in terms of family commitments that affects women in ways that perhaps we'd all thought we were past. And I'm wondering, Camilla, if you wouldn't mind just saying a little bit about your decision to move on. I know that you see it as a positive one, and I know that the gallery is very supportive of you and have been.
Yeah, well, it's very interesting to sort of be part of this discussion. And it's always difficult to know how much a personal experience has any more universal reach. And I thought it'd be interesting to be part of this discussion today to see if between us we could tease out any similarities or differences across women's experience. I mean, for me, I've been in my post 11 years, as you mentioned, and I think my decision, although it is partly to do with the fact that I'm a mum of a three-year-old and I'm juggling that work-life balance, is also probably also to do with the age that I've reached and many other things which have affected how I feel about my work-life relationship, which I think is actually a common experience amongst friends, male and female, and from different sectors as well. And in many ways, it does feel like a particular moment for me because I'm lucky enough to be in a position where I feel that I've achieved what I'd set out with all the burning ambition I had when I was younger, which was to be a curator of a contemporary art gallery. And I was lucky enough to be on a cultural leadership program actually at City University a few years ago when I fell pregnant with a number of other women, and had lots of time to sort of reflect on what I felt I had achieved in my career and what I may wish to achieve in the future. And one of the lessons that came from that for me was that I probably had achieved what I wanted to achieve in terms of my curatorial aspirations and my commitment to wanting to work in a publicly funded charity sector. Which obviously, along with that, comes issues around how much you were paid or how little you were paid, which also affects work-life balance when you're having to take on things like childcare costs, which I know is something you and I have talked about. Mm. But yes, I mean, I felt it was a sort of moment to reflect, and I decided that I'd rather go freelance and sort of float myself on the open market and use the skills and experience I have and see what else I could do in terms of some entrepreneurial ideas that I have and other ways of earning my money, which might increase my earning potential on an hourly rate so that I can have more time with my son.
Okay. Kenny, you founded your architectural practice before you had children?
Yeah, I wasn't really ever that brilliant at working for other people, so I always had my own practice, albeit I did a few months here and there with other practices when I was a student. And it changed obviously dramatically with children, but it was, I think, you know, I'm in a situation where I decided to, albeit it was very difficult, to work with my architectural partner, who is also the father of the children, at that time, so that we talked about going slow, and that's sort of what we did. We did probably one person's job between two of us for a long time. And even then, we had lots of help from. We were able to live with young people who took care of the kids and in bouts, and the thing was like always reinventing itself as the. It's a moving target as kids get older.
Right. Right. And Rachel, you don't have children, but I know that the discussion around work-life balance and the dependency that we have upon others is one that that interests you quite a lot.
Yeah, I mean, for me, this I often think about the art world as from the perspective of a capitalist structure, mm-hmm. Which obviously affects, you know, capitalism. Needs patriarchy and it needs inequality to survive. So I'm quite interested in the structures that we collude with every day when we work in the arts, and the dependency on free labour and inequality and the hierarchies there. So my level of interest comes from those sort of perspectives about this. And I think that, I mean, from my experience, I work a lot with children. I also have just finished a large project with young parents, mostly women, but some men as well. So I suppose I can bring my experience of that. Also, obviously, working with artists who have children, who are parents themselves.
But even the concerns around, how one does it in terms of working in the arts and who can afford to work in the arts, I think is an important conversation to be had, whether you've had children or not, or whether you intend to have children or not. And indeed, that that certain women feel that they have to either leave a post to be able to spend more time with their family. Does that then mean that only the childless can afford then to continue to work in the arts? And I know that this is an issue across many sectors and not just within the arts. But to come back to you, Camilla, something around the idea that that decision has to be made, is it because somehow financially there's not enough of the gain to remain? I know that's not your concerns.
That's quite interesting. I mean, that makes me think of two things. One thing around when you're saying about people who don't have children taking it over, and I think the other side of that is one of the issues in the art world, or the publicly funded art world, is often when women are on maternity leave, they're not replaced. So there is definitely sort of unhealthy dynamics that can be picked up there of people having to do extra work and filling in for other people, which, you know, I'm in a team where a number of us have been on maternity leave, so we've been able to help out for each other, but there can be inequalities there for sure. But also that sort of interface with a capitalist system, the level of remuneration within the publicly funded sector, which of course we're bracing ourselves for getting worse. I think one of the things that hit me was, how can you significantly increase your earning capacity even if I took the next level job up, which would be quite difficult to do part-time, which is how I've been working at the gallery, my earning potential would only be £10,000 to £15,000 more, which isn't enough to sort of cover the cost that you would take on and the extra hours you'd have to work. And I think that is where there's an issue around people, how you then think about work in a transactional way. And I've certainly gone through a process of sort of thinking of myself in that way and thinking, well, how else can I repackage my skill set so that I do try and increase my earning capacity? Because another 10 years in the sector I'm in, I'm not going to be able to seriously break through to the next level of pay, really.
I'm one of five girls, so this morning I was just chatting to my sister about this, because it's been, I'm 50 now, so my kids are 17, 18 and 22. And so in some senses I've come out the other end, but we were just talking about she's got a 6 and 8 year old. We're talking about the different phases of childhood and motherhood and how people assume that it's when kids are really tiny that's the problem. Mm. Time, and there's lots of sympathy at work. But really, it gets more and more intense up to about the age of 14. There's more need for you to be there, to appreciate, to engage, and just do loads of stuff with them. After that, you just need to be there anyway, because you need to be there to be rejected. It's really quite important not to be the absent parent, because there's more and more sort of resentment that builds up at a very low level with young people, I think, if they just feel that they're just, you know, your work comes first. I mean, I think what I've tried to do and failed lots and lots, but succeeded lots and lots too, it's sort of, you know, like a whole personal history here, but is to keep them very much connected with what I do at work. So they know the kind of the highs and the lows, the crazy competition hours, the driving halfway across the country to do some snagging with me on a building site. So I think that's given them a sense that they never want to be an architect, but that it's something that's part of our family life. It's part of their history too.
One of the things that I was thinking about when I was first approached to speak in this programme, and it's something that's relevant at the moment in terms of, I think, the whole of society, is looking at the sort of ways that we work for free. And I was thinking about this in terms of my own position. Like, I work, and always have done, as long as I've been in the arts, but also when I was in the youth service as well, mm-hmm. Beyond the hours that I'm paid to do. You know, I don't clock in and clock out. And I mean, this is very standard. People don't take lunch breaks. They work an hour or so later than they're paid to do. They work weekends. They don't kind of reclaim that time or demand that it's paid for or acknowledged in that way. And I think that to a certain extent, we're all responsible for colluding with this. And by doing this, we prop up this structure, which then actually at one point might force us out if we want to have a choice to balance our lives or to put our energies into raising families or other things that we think are important. How can we work in this system that we've actually helped create and sustain and then make a choice to do both? So I sort of feel like it's a collective responsibility. You know, we're sort of forced, in order to succeed and to climb in our careers, we go extra. You know, it's quite a competitive way of being. And that's very sort of selfish in a lot of ways. We kind of, it's for our own personal gain in lots of ways. And how do we kind of re-examine that and work more in solidarity and collectively, recognising the sort of needs and choices of the other people that we're working with? I don't want to be, because I don't have children, I don't want to be privileged over other women. You know, I don't want to sort of get a job because I don't have kids or get into that role where, you know, my colleagues are struggling and having a really hard time and I'm not because I don't have... Do you see what I mean? So it's like, how do we kind of look at the whole system and the ways that we collude in different ways? It's like, you know, for years, the arts has depended on free internships, for example, and free pay. But then in a broader... To step back and look at this in a broader way, look at the ways that women work for free all over the world. And actually how dependent capitalism and the state are on that free labour. If women withdrew their free labour, such as all the caring roles that we naturally fall into, people would die. You know, it would have a really massive impact on society. And it would, you know, we're actually very powerful when we're collective and when we're strong and united and in solidarity. So I want to say that power is a relationship. We always have a choice about whether we collude with it or not, and that something only has power when we give it power.
But we're also talking about an industry that's not unionised.
Yeah.
And I know, Camilla, that this is something that you and I have talked about also.
Yeah.
How do you hate the term regulate, because in one respect we're so regulated and the state intervenes so much in our lives, but how do we protect workers then in that case?
I mean, this is probably more sort of anecdotal than factual, you know, I don't really have that sort of sense, but I've been a member of a union for a long time and have been involved with trying to encourage more people to become unionised. And I think I'm quite interested over the next 2 or 3 years how the union movement will fare, because there seems to me to be a very big generational divide now amongst attitudes to unions. And I mean, the union that I was a member of is the Transport and General Workers Union, which holds up very good values for workers' rights within its union members, but that bore absolutely no relationship to the types of working rights that were reasonable or possible to negotiate within the small sector that I was in. And so I had a few instances with them of talking through what they would expect you to get when you were a working mum, and it's like, well, that's great, but it's just not going to happen. And I'm worried that there will be a backlash over the next few years, because obviously one of the big financial issues that universities, for example, are facing at the moment is the legacy of final salary pension schemes, and the fact that they are in huge debt because they can't pay these pensions which they are obliged to pay. And it would seem logical that certainly for the next few years there'll probably be a reaction against that, with employers being tougher and tougher of what rights they will offer future generations in terms of what will be the employment contracts over the next 10 years. I mean, it's kind of a worrying time because of the economic situation that we're in, how that's going to impact. And I think it's going to become, on the one hand, more difficult to get workers' rights on the agendas when there's a massive economic recession. But perhaps the student movements that we're seeing and the demonstrations suggest that this could be a really good time to reinvigorate and perhaps remodel the unions and see how they respond to the current climate.
I mean, I think that you're right. There's a huge generational break at the moment. I'm probably on the cusp of it. In that it the kind of content generation that goes on in the arts is more and more being taken online, and very often by women who are full of energy and ideas, and use their blogs or their companies that they set up to explore ideas, collaborations, and do a lot of that. But it's kind of also very easy to have that stolen. It's a really difficult territory to defend. So whilst, you know, the unions had, in some ways, looking back, a much easier time of it defending people's labour, this is intellectual property. And I just had a horrible scene today. I was completely shaken by it. It had been going on all week. You know, you think that you've got your feet on the ground and you've weathered a few recessions, you've got some big children, you know, you've got some buildings that have been built. But there was some, there's been a sort of an IT story in our tiny little architecture practice, which has thrown things completely up in the air for me. There's some people who call themselves a social enterprise who started behaving like you know, people who've broken into your house, you know, charging hours that they say they did on a laptop at home for work in our place. And I found that, you know, I could phone up my union, as it were, the Royal Institute of British Architects, and be passed on to a lawyer for 15 minutes, who then said, oh, yeah, you've got to write a really stiff letter. And then, of course, you realise that the stiff letters in the world of the internet have no purchase power, because if somebody's taken your name as a hosting device. Mm. And then I started talking around to other women, like some consultants, like, say, somebody who's working on creative city planning, and she'd had her name stolen by some Chinese company, and not just the name but the kind of content and her ideas and everything. So I suppose that there is a new frontier out there.
To think about unions, this is a current conversation that we're having at Art Angel as staff, and we're currently looking into which union to join. So we collectively have been looking at this, and I've been really surprised to find out that a lot of galleries are actually unionised, which came as an enormous surprise to me. And I think that there's a different discussion about artists' union access, although that, you know, also from this research that I've been doing, I found that actually there are ways for artists to become unionised, and there are unions that they could work with.
You mean the galleries are unionised among each other, but not with the artists?
Well, I mean, there's different sorts of needs, aren't there, in terms of... So a gallery, for example, Serpentine, is with Bechtu, and the Tate and the National Portrait Gallery are with Prospect, which is a much larger union. So we've been kind of looking at those two and deciding which ones to join. I think the thing that I think is really important to remember is that a union is not going to sort this out for you. You know, the union is only as strong as the organisation within that organisation. So the staff have to be the people that collectively raise the issues and decide what needs to change and then work to change them. And that's up to the staff in terms of their negotiation. A union can legally back and support, and they can help if conflicts come out of that and you're not moving anywhere. That's when a union's useful. And they're also very useful in terms of telling you some of your rights. But I think that... So I've been kind of... I don't know. It feels like a really good thing to find out that there are other galleries out there that are members of unions. Obviously, things that happened at the ICA recently, you know, that was a pretty disastrous time. And I know that there are big fights happening at Tate.
What happened?
The whole restructuring and firing of everyone.
Oh, right. Okay, sorry.
and at the moment, I know that there's quite devastating things happening at Tate in terms of the education departments and everyone having to reapply for their jobs and massive cuts being taken. And I'm sure that will directly affect mostly women, as education departments mostly are women. Within the arts, so.
But I feel slightly concerned. The knowledge I have of the unions that I've worked with have a very patriarchal system as well. I mean,
yeah.
That's an unfair comment, but some I think there's perhaps needs to be a new model of an approach to unionism and how that will work to protect a wider workforce.
I agree, and it's about how do we make sure that women issues are at the front of these conversations rather than this kind of apology at the end and this kind of, oh, we'll deal with that after we've dealt with everything that's really important. You know, because quite often I think, you know, and that's shown socially throughout, that the issues that women, you know, we come to that after we've dealt with all the other stuff, whereas actually it needs to be at the forefront because that's where the sort of basis of inequality happens.
But was this not the great big whitewash about equality, that in terms of rights within the workplace, that there isn't, you know, that everybody has the same rights? So therefore the needs of women are no different from the needs of men.
Yeah, if it helps, I've talked directly to Martina about an experience I had recently where I went to New York and was quite shocked to meet a friend of mine who's a world professional who told me she was pregnant and that although she's entitled to 6 weeks' leave, it will be unpaid, and it is only 6 weeks, which I found really sort of shocking. And then looked online quickly and saw that America does have some of the worst parental rights of the world, you know. And it was kind of seemed to me the sort of end product of equality, because I'd actually gone to New York to be part of a discussion around a show at Museum of Modern Art, which was a photography collection show made up entirely of women artists' work. And so on the one hand, you could say, pat yourselves on the back, that, you know, you've reached this benchmark of equality, and yet the logical effect on women's rights is that there's almost this, what I felt was quite a barbaric situation of this woman, first of all, having to try and go back into work after 6 weeks, which I know women do, but is hard, and then not actually being paid for her time off, which is just going to be very, very difficult for her.
I think that the word equality has come out of this kind of, our understanding of equality is this kind of just a word actually that's used within capitalism and patriarchy to sort of to quieten us down.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that's a patriarchal system, and what you're talking about is a symptom of that. So you know, you're told, oh, well done, now you can wear a suit and go and work in an office as a woman. That's equality. Well, that's not, you know, that's equality in patriarchal terms. It's not actually looking at patriarchy and how do we disassemble that, because actually that's what we need to do, really. We need to change the structure.
I mean, there are campaigns and campaigning organisations that have been very consistently fighting the detail of those situations. So like the Fawcett Society has really looked into how particularly how pensioners have suffered badly through having spent their lives caring for a family and then end their lives in poverty. I mean, I feel like, going back to what you were saying, sort of, you know, a few minutes ago, that I am colluding in this thing, because I'm I get a bit shifty and embarrassed when people talk about a work-life balance, because I'm not only not balancing mine very admirably, like don't take enough weekends off and things, but I'm also like bringing in a younger generation into that sort of way of working by working with interns. In our practice, they're paid, if you know, through Erasmus scholarships and other mechanisms, unless it's for a very short period of, you know, a couple of weeks. But nevertheless, it's a sort of, you're taking people into this world where you say, you know, it's highly competitive, and it's the competition system. Say we did one this week for it's called A Room for London, which is to be on top of the Queen Elizabeth Hall on the South Bank. And it's run by Alan de Botton and his organisation Living Architecture, which is a great sort of attempt to get ordinary people to have the chance to experience contemporary architecture, so you can stay in some quite amazing place in the country. And this would be for the Olympic year, you could stay on the South Bank, you know, above the South Bank, overlooking the Thames. And probably, I don't know, maybe 800 people, maybe 2,000 people, I don't know how many people would have submitted this. But it's that would only be a first stage to a competition. And all of our work is got through pitching and competition. So there's always this kind of like a drug which drives you on, because you're scared of what's, if you don't do that, then you're going to be crawling to people for bread and butter work, which is very unappetizing. So you want to be a winner. And it's very difficult to survive as an architect now, let alone run your own practice if you have kids. So I never have any really great answers.
Are you saying that something has to give?
Yeah, I think it does. I think there needs to be... government needs to understand that if you want to have really high quality architecture in the UK, that you need to get women involved, because it's 50-50 in architecture schools, but it's, you know, sort of 8% at the end of the day who run their own practices. And that is just the pressure at which drives women out, because it's low pay, long hours. And it doesn't need to be there, because it's all about sort of how are buildings procured, and if there's a way to do things without having the system we have now, which is too complicated to go into, but where you have to go through pre-qualification questionnaires and a whole raft of bureaucracy that takes you a week to fill out the forms, and you have to have a cash flow which is going to hit a certain percentage of the value of the building, etc., etc. It means that you need to be part of a large practice, and that just doesn't suit hours of family life or good architecture.
So in order to be able to carry on with your practice, for most women, it seems more agreeable to run their own practice. In terms of being able to, which is what Camilla's talking about, in terms of being able to juggle.
And also to collaborate with all the people that you'd like to collaborate with in the arts, because technicians, it's actually like making a stew, making a building. You want lots of ingredients in there. So it's the freedom to run your own show and make your own content. But it's also obviously that is something that needs to work around a personal life.
I came across, I've heard anecdotally that a lot of women are choosing to set up their own businesses, and I just thought there might be something quite interesting from that. And I was reading about the Shriver report, which is actually a couple of years old now, and Maria Shriver poured in it that 35% of all self-employed people are women now, and that's significantly, it's doubled from 1979 to 2003. So I kind of wonder whether this is the next way that women are becoming more entrepreneurial in lots of different ways and in lots of different sectors, and are starting to develop their own ways of working, their own models of working, where perhaps, you know, we can, there's this balance of there needs to be opportunities, I think, for the next generation to get work experience, to learn about working life and develop those skills. I certainly was the generation that sort of, you had to do voluntary internships in order to be able to get your foot in the door in arts organisations. but maybe we have an opportunity to find new ways of doing that and perhaps find some funding for people to do that too. We can broaden out the class as well as the gender and also bring in issues around cultural diversity within the visual arts sector. That's certainly still a big issue. And I think the barriers are more to do with economic issues than anything else.
I think that I've got a few comments. One is when you're those other issues that you're talking about, Camilla, because I was also thinking very largely about for example around disabilities and being able to work in these contexts, because actually you might it's this idea of you have equality but on these terms. But actually, if you have health needs, which mean that you need to go to regular appointments, or you need a PA, or you have energy issues, or all of those sorts of things, then you can't actually do this job. And it comes down to, for me, I think it's a question of hierarchy, and how organisations are developed around hierarchies. So, and this idea of climbing ladders, and perhaps. This move towards self-employment could be a move towards more collective ways of working.
Yeah.
And how do we kind of share our skills on a more horizontal level where actually everyone can contribute, and it's not just a dominant voice which rules. You know, it's not just white middle-class men that make the decisions, because they're the ones that, you know, have the wives at home looking after the kids and blah, blah, blah. You know, like this kind of archaic structure that we really, it's so sad that we haven't moved on from, but it is absolutely there. And it's, you can see it demonstrated everywhere. You know, these are the rulers. And how do we knock that system over, you know, and create other ways of working where we collectively share childcare, where we collectively share caring for each other, but also collectively share our skills and the responsibility to develop those skills. So it's not just the people that have the privilege of time and money that can gain those skills, but other people can gain skills as well. Mm. You know, it's a privilege to go to university, and it is going to become even more so exactly. than ever. You know, this is a terrifying time. Mm-hmm. And if we don't, you know, I applaud the student movement enormously, but we have to remember that this is a very privileged group of people. Mm. And we can't just focus on their issues. You know, we can't have a conversation about having to leave your job as a curator without thinking, well, how many women are cleaning these galleries and are juggling several cleaning jobs and have absolutely no choice to leave their work to spend time with their children? What about their children, their relationships? You know, we have to kind of make sure that we're listening to other people and other voices, not just the ones that have the privilege of time to think about and discuss like we are doing. Mm. You know, so I think that my feeling is the kind of collapse that's happening at the moment presents us with an amazing opportunity to re-examine how we work. I feel that this invitation to arts organisations to reapply for their funding, you know, is a levelling
to the Arts
ground.
Council you're referring to.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's soon, but wouldn't it be incredible if we all decided that because of the financial cuts that are happening, that, well, strike possibly, but that we reorganise, we shift our structure, you know, we change the way, we change our emphasis, we stop spending the money on the champagne and the private views and the patronage, and we put money into different ways, and we level it out a little bit. You know, I think that as creative people, we can see opportunities, and how do we apply them and work with them, and be brave enough to step away from this kind of normal structure.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is actually happening in pockets. I mean, I went to, on Enterprise Day, I went to Enterprising Women at the Cube in Spitalfields, which is has been set up and run by a woman, and was full of, I mean, you couldn't get around that room fast enough to meet all the amazing people in it. And one of them, called Alison, runs something called Bracket, which is sort of what you're talking about. It's... the Bracket is about bringing different talents together for projects. So instead of everybody pretending that they can punch above their weight, you say, well, we're quick, you know, and we know each other, and so we can assemble, you know, like iron filings around a project when that opportunity arises. And once you get a track record of that happening, that does start to sort of question some of the more snobby attitudes that you have in the arts about, you know, who hands down what and when. So I think that and, you know, in there's a magazine, Precious, which is great for black women entrepreneurs. I don't know, there's co-working that's happening more and more, which is very inspiring around the hubs and other places. There's also co-housing, where people on the internet are sort of deciding to buy a plot together and create a space where their kids can grow up together, so, you know, sharing in that way. So I think it's almost like sort of seeing what's out there and inspiring each other and trying to get the pace of that speeded up, I agree. But, you know, we talked a lot about women, but it would be quite interesting to turn the thing on its head and say, well, how come Jamie Oliver caught, you know, the imagination of the press? How was that so powerful? Could it be quite good to have to look at how men have been supportive? And you could say, well, I'm in a really lucky position because I've got this, like, perfect new man. But three out of, the five of us sisters have got men who are actually carrying the most of the childcare, even though they've got their own businesses too. So I think it's a sort of recognising, like we said in the beginning, that it's got to be a kind of a thickening of connections and that one shouldn't sort of divide along gender lines.
Well, I know that's a lovely number, three out of five, and you and your sisters have chosen well, but I don't think by any stretch of the imagination that's the norm. And in fact, I know it's
but
not.
But can't you shame them into it?
Shame them into it?
If you're choosing to have children with somebody, you need to know that. You need to know your service level agreement right from the start.
I think there are quite a few of us who didn't enter into that contract before we had our children, and I'm thinking it might be a little difficult to stamp that one now. But I know that through Enemies of Good Art, the amount of people who are getting in touch with us, and I've never branded it, or we have never branded it as a movement that solely deals with issues around women's concerns. But we are constantly getting emails from women. And I have a friend, and I wanted to talk about the idea of dependency again. And I have a friend who's just visited me the other day from Canada. She's an artist, and she studied with me at the Royal College of Art. And she's recently had a baby. Her baby's 4 months old now. And she said to me quietly, she said, I can't come back to London. I can't come back to London as a single mother with no family around me. Because how am I going to do all of this on my own? And because London is prohibitive in many ways. And, you know, I've brought up the idea of London, the city, London in particular, as a phenomenon that I have concerns with. And I think, you know, it lacks that community. It lacks the idea of community spirit. And David Cameron's, you know, and I keep going on about big society because I'm going to scream every time I hear it. But for her coming back without some sort of collective network around her, which used to be the family, means that she feels that London is no longer open to her. And I thought about it, and I thought, no, there are ways that this can work, you know, renting with another parent or two other parents who might have kids, who might be single parents also, you know, might be a lovely experience. And I know that's something that she had in her childhood. But it's increasingly difficult to pull this one off. And that idea of dependency, I know that I wouldn't be able to do all the work around Enemies of Good Art that I'm doing if I didn't have a partner. And I know that, Camilla, you know that you can leave your post because you have the backup of a partner time.
Absolutely.
And Susan Bright talked about this on our very first show, where she said she felt privileged to be able to go back to study her PhD. She's living in New York, but her partner got a permanent position. So if we're dependent on partners, a lot of women also, but we're also dependent on the state. We're also dependent, we are dependent upon someone to take our children if we're going to work. And the battle then between who takes your children and how much time you spend away from them, and, you know, do you sacrifice the time you have with your children to be able to be the best you can be and get those big commissions and win those big competitions? Otherwise, you are doing the bread and butter work. So that idea of dependency, some way, you know, brings us back to being children again, where, you know, and then motherhood does that, unless you're, of course, there are lots of men who stay at home to take care of children. Mm. But then they become dependent on their partners. I don't know.
I mean, for me, this is, again, so society rewards a heterosexual model. It's a very heteronormative assumption that women have babies with men, and that one of them, probably the man, can support that woman, can support the children and the woman. So therefore, it doesn't favour single mothers or like, for me, I'm part of the queer community. So what I see there is a kind of a choice, and probably through also being forced into doing things very differently. So a lot of my friends who have children, who are lesbian single mothers, who don't, you know, who can't afford to have children medically, so they're, you know, they're forced mm-hmm. into finding different ways of kind of building community in order to have children, mm-hmm. And therefore those communities also are very, you know, the queer community is very good at supporting families and kind of living together and looking after each other and seeing family as not something that you're not necessarily born into, but that's something that you create around you, which I think is very important and exciting, and and far more empowering for women. In my feeling is that's more empowering. I don't want to go into a relationship with a man or a woman where I'm sort of needing that dependency, but I'm happy to sort of be part of a community where I give and take and share that responsibility as well. So, but you know, definitely economically, the system favours heterosexual relationships. Mm. You know, you can't, how can you live on your own and have a baby and afford to pay your rent?
It's
you
tough.
Know, yeah, how on earth do you do that? Yeah, so.
I read an article in Stylist magazine. It's part of one of the newspapers, the evening London newspapers. I can't remember which. But the question was, can you afford to have me? And there was a picture of a beautiful bonny baby on one side. And then, of course, the article about who can afford to have children now and why women are leaving it so late to have their first child. And partially to do with the fact that, something that I've read through the art that I thought was quite frightening was the idea that women don't feel financially secure, and more so now in the current economic climate, where women are feeling more threatened and are about to lose jobs, are fearful for their jobs, so are putting it off or don't see it as a possibility. And there was a story about one woman who felt that she didn't feel that she could buy a house, because she couldn't buy a house, so she had to rent. She didn't want to bring a child into that sort of environment, and also rents are going up. So therefore, you know, we've been having children later for a while now, which makes life a little bit more tricky. And you did talk about your age, Camilla.
I did talk about my age, yes.
We won't ask you how old you are.
I'm coming up to 40 next year, and I suppose, yeah, I've definitely left it late in life. And I think I'm in two minds about it. I'd be quite interested to hear your next radio programme about that. Mm-hmm. I think there's some really positive things about it as well, actually, in terms of it's probably, in terms of my career trajectory, easier now I've developed my expertise and area of knowledge that to now I have the flexibility to be able to work more part-time, and I have more sort of power in many ways because I've sort of gone up the ladder. It would have been really, really difficult to, when I was earlier in my career, to have, although biologically it probably would have been better to have children then, it would have been much more difficult, I think. And I have a very good friend who had children in her early 20s and who's now sort of coming through the other side of that and is really developing her career as a director and a film director, and she's doing brilliantly. But we've often talked about that, those different decisions that she and I made and the different things that happened in our lives because of that. And although I think there's pros and cons, and I think, of course, it's very expensive to have kids. It always has been. And you can always be put off by those articles letting you know how much it's going to cost. I think I'm also aware that there's a sort of always quite a derogatory way of looking at older mothers that perhaps I would be keen to try and to redress in some way and say, you know, that in some ways, for me personally, I've achieved a lot of what I want to achieve in my career, and I'm more than happy now to step back and spend time with my son while he's growing up, and I know I have a very, very long working life ahead of me because I'm probably going to have to work into my 70s the way the pension schemes are going. So I'm sort of aware this is another chapter, and in many ways the fact that I feel I've fulfilled a lot of my aspirations means I'm quite relaxed about saying, well, okay, I'm going to change that a bit now and come off the career stepping ladder for a bit to really think about what I want, but also to invest my time in my child's upbringing. And I think maybe that's a very privileged position to be in, but it can be a positive thing.
I think I just wanted to say that I hear what you're saying about that there's often a derogatory way of looking at older mothers, but having just also spent 2 years working with young parents, I think there's an enormous derogatory way of looking at younger parents. But then it made me think, well, actually, there's just derogatory ways of looking at mothers, full stop, isn't there? You know, I think women are constantly kind of criticised and kind of scrutinised for the choices that they do or don't make, and the ways that they mother and don't mother, and you know, like there's so much judgment out there. And probably that we internalise a lot as well. And I do think that women, in lots of ways, are our own worst enemies. We have to sort of, you know, it's Augusta Boal that talks about rejecting your oppressor from within. You know, this, and that goes back to my thing about power as a relationship. Like, we have to realise that so much of this we do to ourselves.
Yeah.
And actually that's the strongest thing we could do, kind of reject the things that we... you know, the guilt or the responsibility feelings that we have, and understand those through a feminist dialogue and then change them. You know, that's... I think that people always queue up to criticise women, mothers of any age, but... yeah.
But I think this idea of networks and pooling resources is also quite interesting. It's certainly something that I've become more interested in with going freelance. Is I'm really, it's really fantastic that it's opened up an opportunity for me to work with different friends, like my friend who is a film director. We're brewing a little plan together to work together for the first time. One of the projects I'm taking on is actually working with my mum, who's an artist, and I've not had a chance to sort of work with her on shows of her work. And I think there's some fantastic things that you can make happen through those sorts of networks, and it'd be great to sort of try and keep that going through platform that Martina's worked so hard to develop with Enemies of Good Art as well.
Yeah, I think those networks are important, but I think also, and I keep harping back to the idea that the choices that women still feel that they have to make, and women within the workplace as well. I know the Photographers Gallery is very supportive of you, and that Brett Rogers is very supportive of parents in general, because she's a parent also herself, but there are choices, there are institutions that aren't so forgiving of women.
Yeah, I think, and I think the art sector, I think in many ways that it's a good sector to be in, because for the pros and cons of it, that it's much more open to flexible working and part-time working and people working more remotely from the office. I mean, it's very open in that way, and I know women who work in other sectors where they just don't have that flexibility at all. It's full-time and long hours or not at all, and so they really struggle as they're trying to juggle all the different challenges of life, whether it's children or elderly parents or other things that can happen to them. So I think that there are really positive sides to the industry that we're in as well as negative sides of it. But I think, you know, this whole thing about choice is the situations that arise which you feel you have no control over, and the situations which arise because you take control and you make decisions to do things in a slightly different way. And I don't feel that my hand was forced in any way. I wouldn't want it to sort of seem that way. I think there's a lot of very powerful women within the art world and directors of organisations. And it's really, they're good role models for women to sort of see other women succeeding and managing to that juggle. And as I mentioned earlier, there's different phases of children and the phases they go through of growing up, and different stages for women when they can come back into the workplace and take a much more leadership role.
But do we feel that women still are achieving the same rates of pay, for example, as their male counterparts in any sector of society, even within the administrative arts?
Which is, I think, surprising. I mean, it's quite shocking when you read these statistics, and unfortunately they do tend to be borne out that for various reasons and in various ways, women do tend to, even, you know, in the visual arts sector, as much as any other will earn less than their male peers, even when there's fewer men working in the sector. And I was curious about some of the debates around the film The Dagenham Girls, which looks at this movement for equal pay and how much that has actually, in real terms, addressed and how much that's achieved for women, which I know goes back to the discussions we've had about equality and the issues around the system that you're in within that. But I still find that quite shocking. And I kind of feel I've reached a point where I want to do something about that in the way that I can, which for me is about rethinking my relationship to work and sort of forcing my pay up by changing my patterns of work.
And by saying no, because, I mean, you're swapping an employer, if you like, for clients, they always want an extra little bit of work, something tweaked outside the original sort of thinking on the project. So I think it's one of those things where you're going to be making, because you've got a good network, you're going to be making another world for yourself that could tackle just through example, you know, how you're not going to underpay people, you know, working on a shoot or whatever it is. Mm. And I think that is exciting because, you know, you're taking your value system, your ethos through to your... every aspect of your work, if you like.
Mm.
What I find frustrating in architecture, okay, we're still in the arts, is that we could do miracles because it's a very can-do profession. It's a very sort of can-do art form. It then starts hosting other art forms and then it lives on as a different environment that gets interpreted by so many people. The trouble is that we're forced at the moment into so much... bean counting, that there isn't actually time to get on with the real work. So the amount of sort of government distraction and regulation, the way that we're working for contractors who are enemies of art, if you like, means that nobody is trusting the art in architecture to produce something of value. So everything has to be the subscript always, and that you justify things on British research establishment environmental assessment method points, which means that you don't get a point for providing a place for a bicycle, but you do if it's undercover. And there's like millions and millions of little bits of absurdity that you negotiate around. And it means that, you know, for women working there, that, I mean, I've just been hosted a few returners courses. The London Metropolitan University is running courses for women who want to return to architecture after a break. Well, not just for women, for men as well. And the fear is that you've missed some of these beans, that you've come in maybe 3 years later, even not even a few years later, and that somehow you're no longer going to be competent as a professional, even though you've done your 7 years training and, you know, 5 or 10 years working in the profession. There's always people to make you feel sort of insecure that you've... And it's on complete minutiae. So there are things that could be done, as you say, like you're reassessing the way that you would collaborate and produce projects. I think in architecture it's just essential, because otherwise everything will just be a standard building.
Mm. I think it's something to do with how you how we also validate and value ourselves as women, and the things that we do. So we can talk about sort of having to get work experience in a gallery, but I, you know, am working for free. But I recently interviewed a woman who was older and who had an older child, and was asking the same set of questions and realised that she couldn't answer them. She wouldn't answer them based on her own experiences. And maybe this is a massive assumption to make, but I felt that it was because she didn't see, think that that was the answers that I was looking for, that, that it wasn't. You know, actually, if you spend 10 years raising a child, you have an amazing set of skills and experience that's really flexible and really versatile and very valuable in a workplace. So, but how do we kind of articulate that value? This is a really important, this is not time out. This is a really important contribution to society and to people. So how do we kind of shift the value system within this, the structure as well? Again, you know, it's a patriarchal system. It doesn't hear these voices. It doesn't hear, you know, it doesn't hear children. It doesn't hear women. It hears men. So how do we kind of really affect that?
I mean,
that?
I think that's a really interesting point. And I think one of the things I took, certainly from the cultural leadership course I did, that was incredibly valuable for me to be have the opportunity. And it was fully funded, actually, through European funds at City University. And it was for women only. And it brought together women from across the theatre, performing arts, sectors, and it was incredibly helpful. And I think really the big thing that most of my peers on the course, if I can speak on their behalf as well, the biggest thing it probably did for most of us was just increased our confidence. And it sort of annoyed me that I still lacked confidence, even though I've been in this professional sphere for so long. I think it's amazing how much women really do need to feel that valued and to feel able to sort of speak about themselves and have the, I mean, just this step that I've made is actually, I needed to feel very confident to be able to do it. But it was almost as soon as I was empowered in that way and given that psychological lift to think, well, of course I can do it, then everything else fell into place. So I think there's a lot that can be done through women supporting each other, but also recognising that it is about valuing and what you do outside of work as well as in work in all those different ways.
I know, and there's a lot to be said about women's confidence or the lack of. And we're going to we're into the last few minutes of the show, so if anybody has any burning comments they'd like to make, now would be the time. I'm so sorry, I'm snuffling the whole way through this, so I apologise to our listeners for those awful sounds.
But you're just not allowed to apologise. That's the first rule.
Yeah.
Okay, so I don't. Just I'll have to put up with
we
it.
We need to stop apologising. It's time to stop apologising.
I know that from the nine shows that we've done so far, we've had some really heated discussion, and we've also had a lot of discussion around the same subjects that keep coming up and up again. The idea of women's confidence, our dependency upon others, you know, changing the paradigm, changing the situation so that we see it from a different point of view in terms of it being less patriarchal systems in general. And also the positions that women find themselves in. But I think our liveliest show had to be a show 2 weeks ago on feminism and feminist ideas. And I think somehow it seems like it's a bit of a shame to me that that we're not further along in the game, and somehow we thought we were, and somehow there's been a denial of that, and so by denying it means we don't have to do anything about it, but recognizing that there are issues and concerns means that, you know, don't we have a responsibility for the next generation to try and make the situation better?
I think that we are further along than we realise, but I also think that we've been told we've succeeded,
right?
And we have to make sure that we don't listen to that, because that's capitalism speaking. You know, it wants us to go back to sleep.
Well, my eldest two are girls, and they have just been totally shocked by the outside world. You know, what's acceptable at university? What kind of chat is tolerated? So,
I think it's the danger is to think there isn't still a danger there, and to believe that the battle has been won. Because I think on certain levels and in certain areas that there's still a long, long way to go, and there's almost a shutdown of any discussion. So I think it's important to just keep it moving forward and keep addressing the issues that we face.
Definitely.
Totally.
Yeah, I think so. And I think on that note, we can end this discussion. And thank you, Camilla, over the phone.
Well, thank you.
Due to bad weather conditions, Camilla couldn't get in.
You may have heard my son shouting in the background. I hope not.
No, we did hear a little bit of him, but not nearly enough. But thanks to Rachel and Kenny, and thanks for listening. And I hope that you'll join us again on the 14th of February for our next show.